program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, where the Southeast Center at 82nd and Division is now a full-fledged campus, allowing students to earn an associate's degree in their own neighborhood. PCC celebrates on October 18th at noon with campus tours, local food vendors, and live Afro-Cuban music by Melio de Cuba. pcc.edu/celebrate. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon. Committed to helping our community's most vulnerable people for over 100 years and to giving them a hand up rather than a hand out. More information is available on the web at voa.org.
Join us for our monthly movie event, KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on October 9th, KBOO will host a screening of The U.S. vs. John Lennon, a 2006 documentary film about John Lennon and his transformation from Beatle to anti-war activist and the repression he faced because of his political activities. That's KBOO at the Clinton with The U.S. vs. John Lennon on Thursday, October 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Fight the Power on KBOO. That's the theme of this year's News and Public Affairs Day, this Friday, October 10th, from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Highlights include Nation magazine columnist Katha Pollitt talking about her new book, Pro Reclaiming Abortion Rights, and the ALEC Project, an investigation of Oregon legislation which has been influenced or created by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. So fight the power and support KBOO. That's News and Public Affairs Day this Friday from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Good morning. Today is Monday, October 6, 2014, and you are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.FM. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with my co-host, Celeste Carey, and joining us this morning is Todd R. Clear, co-author with Natasha A. Frost of The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. Professor Clear, we're glad that you are joining us this morning. And as you may know, we are in the midst of a membership drive, so we will have breaks in our interview so that our listeners may call in to 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm to support this community radio station. But before we go to our first break, we would like to give you an opportunity to give us a snapshot view of the philosophy concerning the purpose of sentencing of sentencing and imprisonment in America. And when we come back, we will explore more of your critique of the system and your proposed alternative. So tell us something about the history of crime and punishment, and more particularly sentencing in America.
Well, America has a unique sentencing history. The recent history is particularly important to understand. So for most of the history of the United States, the dominant orientation toward sentencing was to put limits on the on the length of stay of people in prison and put limits on the number of people going to prison. So for as long as we've been able to record the statistics, the incarceration rate, the number of people locked up per 100,000 citizens, the incarceration rate in the United States has been around 100 per 100,000. Beginning in the early 1970s, however, the policy about incarceration in the United States began to change. Natasha Frost and I have argued that it's that you can think of this change as a kind of a social experiment in punishment. And the rate of imprisonment started to grow, and it grew uniformly for the next 40 years or so. Nowhere in the history of the world has that kind of change occurred, other than in the United States. And by the by 2010, the incarceration rate in the United States was. The imprisonment rate in the United States was over 500 per 100,000, almost 600 per 100,000. If you count people in jails, it was almost 800 per 100,000. So we had almost an eightfold increase in a 40-year period in the rate at which we use imprisonment. And the way we did that was to systematically reduce the use of non-prison alternatives at sentencing and systematically increase the length of stay of people who go to prison. So in the early 1970s, about one-fourth of the people who were sentenced for a felony went to prison. By the year 2010, more than three-fourths went to prison. And of the one-fourth who didn't go directly to prison, about half of them had jail as a condition of their sentence. And in the early 2000s, as best we can understand it, the median length of stay was about 14 or 15 months. Per person, length of stay in a prison sentence. Today, it's more than double that, and as a result, even though the crime rate today is about what it was in the 1970s, we have between 5 and 8 times as many people incarcerated in the United States. And again, that particular orientation toward imprisonment has not been. Seen any time else in history, anywhere else in the world.
We're going to just let our listeners just reflect on those numbers. They may be startled by some by some of those numbers, but also realize that this is a system that cannot be sustained. And in fact, you offer some solutions and some observations about whether or not it has plateaued and what are some of the alternatives. But we're going to allow our listeners to become members of KBOO by calling us at 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm and also offer them the opportunity to get a volume of this book, The Punishment Initiative. Imperative, I'm sorry.
Yes. Good morning, Cecil. Thanks for coming down. And thank you, Mr. Frost, for being on the air with us today. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in and calling 877-500-5266. That's the number you call to do your part and become a full member of the KBOO Foundation, which runs and operates KBOO 90.7 FM. How about KBOO.FM, where you can do the whole thing online, and it's secure, it's confidential. You can be as an you.
It's easy.
Yes.
It's absolutely easy.
Miss Celeste is in the house.
Yes, I am. We have a goal to reach today.
That's right. We're trying to raise.
So if we break that down, say, to 10 listeners paying $50, how much would that be? How many listeners would we need, new members?
Well, we're trying to raise $500 by 9 a.m., and that is easy to do.
Because 10 people.
Because at least 9 of you are going to call 877-500-5266 and become monthly sustaining members with just $5 a month. Over the course of the year, that comes to $60 just from each and every one of you, or from each of those 9 folks who are going to call 877-500-5266. Perhaps we'll get a few bonus folks who log on to KBOO.fm and use the safe, convenient, easy, and secure web form to keep their tax dollars, their dollars, not to be sucked up by taxes, but instead to be circulating and empowering and invigorating and financing the community.
Now, because we're doing this early in the day, it's a good idea to think, will my employer match my contribution?
Many of them will. We'll include information on that when we send you your membership materials. And there's yet another bonus, as Cecil mentioned. Kristen's got some info right here.
Yes. The book, The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarcerations in America, the book is up for grabs. You can have this important book by making a $60 minimum pledge. It's a retail value of $30. The Punishment Imperative, it cautions that the legacy of the grand experiment of the past 40 years will be difficult to escape. However, we have a way out. The authors suggest that the United States now stands on the threshold of a new era in penal policy. And there is practical and pragmatic policy solutions in this book. So let's educate ourselves and find out what we need to do. Call 877-500-5266.
And I bet we're going to get into a little of those practical solutions right now as we return to more of More Talk Radio.
Thank you so much, Membership Central, for giving us ways to become members. And one of the advantages of membership here at KBOO is that you get a chance to hear some groundbreaking and penetrating interviews. We've got with us here today Todd Clear, who is co-author of The Punishment Imperative. And when we left, we were talking about how the numbers of incarcerated people, as well as the length of stay, and to a degree, what crimes were the triggers, the triggers for their incarceration, have expanded, risen during the time, but are also unsustainable. Now, in your book, you liken this to, as you said, a grand social experiment. But one of the differences between this particular experience and the grand experiments was I guess we'll call it planning. This one seems to have been an experiment without really a sound vision or a strategy. Is that true?
One of the points we make in the book is that that most other social experiments, like Social Security or mandatory public education, took place with a deliberate idea to try to carry out this a social reform that had some strong public backing, and in this case there was not the same kind of public debate. On the other hand, there was strong public consensus that we ought to get tougher on crime. It started in the mid 1970s under Nixon's law and order campaigns, and it stayed really as a strong theme for more than 20 years, in a sense, without any particular way of going out and measuring it, the general public as a whole seemed to feel that there was a need for expanded use of imprisonment, greater punishments for people who are convicted of crimes, and a tougher public response to in the criminal justice system. So in that sense, the experiment metaphor really does work. It is very much like some of the other great social experiments we've done in the United States, in which sort of there was this public outrage about a problem, in this case crime, a growing public consensus about what to do about it, in this case lock up more people, and then a set of consequences from this new public policy that is currently being explored.
So what we see then is kind of this juggernaut beginning to get some steam. But some of the questions are what were some of the fears that perhaps were reframed to reflect crime as opposed to just social unrest, especially given the time when we're looking at this very, very, very late 60s, early 70s with the war on crime and the war on poverty having just ended and then kind of morphing into the war on drugs. It's kind of hard to ignore the fact that it seems to be targeting not only lower income, lower socioeconomic populations, but also race figured very prominently in this.
And there's no question that race was at the center of the public imagination about the crime problem and about what to do about it.
And social unrest with the lack of change.
Right. So in the 70s, there was just a lot of so crime in the streets was an issue, but disorder in the streets was an issue, and public demonstrations were an issue. So demonstrations against the war were going on at the same time that there was a very strong public civil rights movement that involved public demonstrations and public activity. At the same time that crime rates had been growing really for a decade, for more than a decade, leading people to conflate these three kinds of disorders. So public disorder, this idea that things had gotten out of control and the state needed to get control of things again. And that was an underlying idea. And in the center of all of it was race, because the civil rights movement was about race. Public crime and let's also say quote riots in the streets close quote was about urban areas in which largely minority neighborhoods, Watts, Newark, and other cities, there were public what we came to call public riots that took place in largely African American urban areas, and politicians like Richard Nixon were successful about linking the civil rights movement to the crime problem through Willie Horton, and later George Bush, the first George Bush, through the Willie Horton ads. This idea that somehow that civil rights, anti-war work, urban riots, and disorder in the streets were all linked produced an underlying theme of race that was often not explicit but very much implicit.
And as we saw this change in strategy in terms of how to approach social unrest, I think it might have been difficult for people to reflect carefully on whether or not mass incarceration worked and or whether or not it dealt with in an adequate manner the social problem. You note in your book that crime in recent years has declined, yet there seems to be a continued popular myth that we are under siege. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. So it is true that that nationally crime rates have been dropping for more than a decade. But we also argue in the book that the underlying public consensus.
Yeah.
That you must get tough on crime is also eroding.
Yes.
So, for example, politically, you don't see people running for office on get tough platforms anymore in the way that you used to. It used to be really dangerous when you were a politician, you had to calculate how your opponent was going to characterize you as being soft on crime, and you had to be able to counter that you're not soft on crime. That kind of political vulnerability isn't the same as it once was. You have mayors running for office not talking about crime at all. Crime has not been, when crime was an issue in the elections of everybody up to, of presidential elections of everybody up to through Clinton, and let's face it, Clinton. Presidents don't do much about crime, but crime was central in those elections. After Clinton, really, crime was not talked about at all. In the Obama, two Obama elections, crime was not an issue at all. Many urban mayors in cities that have significant crime issues, crime is not the central part of their debate. Governors are running for office, and very often crime is not at the center of what they are talking about. So what's happened has been that the heat that public safety generated, that crime in the streets generated, has to a great extent dissipated. And so the kind of while I think it's also the case that we're in the early days of this change, and there's plenty of public of leftover public sentiment about the relationship between crime and punishment, that there's other issues that are much higher on the public mind. And crime, for example, has not been in the top three or five of the public polls about things that people are worried about for 15 years.
And so as we encourage our listeners to call, I want them to think about how their minds have changed. And when we come back with Professor Clear, we'll talk more in depth in terms of this public transition and what are some of the solutions that he proffers. But give us a call at 877-500-5266.
So Membership Central, how are we doing in terms of bolstering the morale of those who are looking to become new members and connecting them with the joy they can feel of being part of the winning combination of KBOO Information and you?
Well, we are marching towards our very modest goal. We're trying to raise $500 by 9 a.m., and we are just about 20% of the way there. And we can get that last 80% very easily with your help, dear listener, when you call 877-500-5266. While you're at it, why not sweeten the pot a little bit for yourself by giving $5 or more every single month to KBOO and get yourself your very own copy of The Punishment Imperative. This is a fascinating topic for me. I hold a bachelor's degree in criminology, and this is exactly the sort of stuff that I spent a few years and no few dollars to get a grip on. And this is where I learned, and this is it's taking me right back. Taking me right back and reminding me of all the stuff that, like, how crime has been on a steady decline for the past 25 years, but incarceration keeps going up and up. What's that about? And this is exactly the sort of issue that got me fired up about struggles for justice in the first place. And I'm so grateful for these authors to these authors for putting this book out and making it, and to the publisher for making it available to new and renewing KBOO members, and to the professor here for making the time to speak with Cecil and Celeste, and speaking to you, dear listener. So why not mirror that? Why not reflect that generosity back to KBOO with your investment in community radio? 877-500-5266. Make a gift right now for all your friends and neighbors who rely on KBOO to bring them this sort of crucial and deep information that you all need. You have come to rely on this, and KBOO relies on you for support. 877-500-5266.
Yeah, the prison system relies on corporate dollars to keep them in operation. We rely on people dollars to keep us in operation so that we can continue to show you what's going on in the world, so we can get our collective imperative together. There's a real need to know what's going on, and we can't know because corporations own most of our media outlets. So this is what we have to work with, and it's not bad. We have transmitters all over the state. We have a really healthy online community, and we are all international and worldwide. So why not get involved? Why not support this thing that is KBOO? That's an international media outlet. Extend our reach. Help us get stronger, because this is what we have to work with, and it's yours. So today, call 877-500-5266.
One of the sickest things about mass incarceration is that so many of these prisons are privately owned and operated, which means that their goal is not public safety, but profit. And anyone with that kind of pull who can get state legislatures to pay them to house the incarcerated population also has the pull to force laws that the goals of which are more incarceration and not public safety, that often come at the expense of public
That's
safety.
Right.
When people who, there are a few people who actually belong in prison, and then they're being let out to make room for people who shouldn't be there. And it's, this is what we are trying to, we're trying to get the word out about this and educate you, the listening public, and that's where you come in. 877-500-5266. Cecil, Celeste?
Thank you so much. And once again, we want to encourage you to become a member. Get a book. This is a great book and a great opportunity to not only learn more about some of the failures of the system and to be able to pinpoint and give a concise and coherent argument, but it gives some solutions to the current, I'll call it overreach. We'll call it public safety or incarceration overreach, in that this is a system, as our authors have said, cannot be sustained.
So, Professor Clear, when we ended our conversation last, you were explaining some of the myths and some of the reality of changing social in our society in terms of attitude towards crime and criminality in general. With this shift or recognition by politicians and by communities throughout about the how we can no longer sustain mass incarceration, but we may offer different alternatives. What are some of the things that you see of the opportunities that we now have in recent years to address many things that you touch upon in your book in terms of social problems in general and specifically around the criminal justice system?
Well, the three main forces that have led to the we argue is the waning of the punishment imperative, the idea that no matter what the question is, the answer is more punishment. The three things that have changed are that crime rates, after peaking in the 80s and once again in the early 90s, have been steadily declining, pulling a lot of the pressure off of political leaders and social leaders to deal with, to respond to crime-related agendas. That's one. A second is that the cost of a large prison system is prohibitive, and these are dollars that come off the top of public revenues. So the it's not like you can reset a correctional fiscal plan every year. The number of prisoners on December 31 of a year determines what the cost of the prison system is going to be in the following year. So the first budgets that go in are the correctional budgets, and after that, everybody else gets in line. Mm-hmm. And the tremendous fiscal pressure in other areas, healthcare, infrastructure, aging, education, these are the public sense that we need to make more investments in these areas is reducing the pressure to make investments in the prison system area. And even when fiscal times get better and the pressure on local and governments is reduced, the fiscal pressure on local governments gets a little bit relieved, there's going to be a lot of people in line making claims for additional resources, including the education system, healthcare system, roads, infrastructure, retirement, and so on. and the kind of monopoly that the prison system had on public concerns is gone, and it's gone really, and we would argue, permanently. The third main force has been that there's been a ton of now new criminological research on the relationship between incarceration rates and crime rates and on the nature of crime and so on. And it's pretty clear that the size of the prison population has a very attenuated relationship to the size of the crime rate. So today we have, depending on how you count, between 5 and 7 times as many prisoners in the United States. We have essentially the same crime rate that we had in the 70s. So it's not easy to argue that if you increase the number of prisoners, you're going to drive down crime, because over that time period, crime has gone up and down several times, but incarceration rates, the number of people who are incarcerated, has simply grown the entire time period. It would be crazy to argue there's no relationship between the number of people in prison and the amount of crime, but it's very clear that growing the prison population has not had an impact on the crime rate in the same way that you would have expected it in the early 70s. So this set of forces, a new set of public claims on public revenues, a strong set of empirical evidence showing that the prison population doesn't produce safety in the way we had thought it would, and strong fiscal pressures on local prison populations, on local governments that have to pay for prison populations. These have produced a change in the public mindset about incarceration.
Well, can I talk about, and if can you kind of touch on another impact that we discuss, but we discuss it off the ledger, so to speak, and that is the effect that mass incarcerations have cost us in terms of community devastation, families being devastated, the lessening of our workforce, the fact that we have a large amount of populations coming out who may or may not have skills to contribute to community stability. How does that figure in also to the failure of the punishment imperative?
Well, one of the areas where the research has been most significantly stunning has been research on the long-term implications of a growing prison population for communities. This is some of this is my own research, and some of it is research that we've done that Natasha Frost and I have done together. It turns out that incarceration rates are concentrated in inner-city impoverished communities, and they are sufficiently concentrated that in some of these places, up to 1/4 of the men are locked up on any given day, but it's a different set of men locked up from time to time. You have people cycling in and out, mostly men, but also women cycling in and out of the prison system over time, and this creates whole neighborhoods where the prison is a major presence in the social and family life of that neighborhood. So, for example, one of the things we know, and the devastating implications for neighborhoods are pretty clear. One of the things we know is that going to prison reduces lifetime earnings by 40%. Mm-hmm. But if you have a neighborhood where most of the men have been in prison, then you have a neighborhood where most of the men are earning almost half the money that they would have earned if they hadn't gone to prison. And these entire neighborhoods, fiscal capacity to generate, to keep businesses there, to generate economic activity for the families to provide support for their children, all of that is reduced. It is not a surprise then to know that one of the best predictors of a child going to prison, controlling for everything else, is having the parent go to prison. If you are a child of a person who's gone to prison, your chances of getting involved in the criminal justice system are increased by 25%. And in neighborhoods where they have high rates of people cycling in and out of the prison system, attitudes toward the legitimacy of the criminal justice system and the legitimacy of the political system are reduced. And we know that going to prison reduces likelihood of a person getting married to a person they're living with when they're released from prison. So these are all ways in which the growth of the prison system in the United States has been associated with destabilizing aspects of social life particularly in African American or minority neighborhoods in inner cities. And these long-term community level consequences are part of how the story has changed. People are beginning to recognize these, and they simply seem unjust. And while you can make an argument that so-and-so maybe so-and-so should go to prison for his or her crimes, you really have a lot of trouble making an argument that a social policy that we would have that would have these kinds of devastating implications for communities and for people who themselves have never been to prison, that's a social policy that we have to rethink.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland. We're speaking with Professor Todd Clear, who is co-author along with Natasha Frost of The Punishment Imperative. Join us. We are taking calls 503-231-8187. And to talk about ways that we can both recognize the costs and the undeniable loss of the prison imperative, the punishment imperative, but also to look at solutions. We'll take your calls again, 503-231-8187. We'll go to Francis. Good morning. You're on the air. Thanks for holding.
Hi. This is a very interesting conversation today. Having been involved with a family that's probably been part of this social experiment, I find some things in our family that contradict the norm, but I also see a lot of things that are pretty tragic. You know, one thing I would like to say is that having a husband who has been incarcerated for many years and was recently released, I find that the supervision that people have to go through or tolerate when they are released is almost as frustrating as being incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And I have children who are not in prison, and I think I would like to emphasize the stress that's put on the parent who does not go to prison to try to maintain a household and encourage the children to continue to be successful in their lives. And I find it really offensive that it is a social experiment, quote unquote. People are people, and they're dealing with a whole lot of things. And I would like to know more about the politicians such as Kevin Mannix, who I recently heard, although he may not be involved in some of these private contractors involved in the prison industry. Some of his friends and family are, and he was one that promoted the Measure 11 and the mandatory minimums and all of that. Mm-hmm. And yes. I would like to hear more about the resolution and the reparations to people who have had to endure this social experiment. That's about all I have to say, because the topic is very, it angers me quite a bit to see what people have to tolerate on a day-to-day basis while we're intellectualizing about the social experiment.
Thank you for your call.
And for putting a human face on this issue. When we talk about this being a quote-unquote grand social experiment, it's not just objectifying it and getting some distance from it to do academic study. It's more of looking at, if I understand it correctly, Professor Clear, that it's a way of both quantifying the policies and effects that went into it and the mindset that went into it, but also looking at it as a way of, this is how I would say it. It is a social experiment in that it's social engineering of a sort. And if I understood some of Francis's frustration, it's a kind of a callous way of putting people into a subcategory. It creates a population whose only option is indenturement. You know, you will only be able to do menial jobs. You'll only be able to move within a very constricted area. Your rights as a citizen are kind of limited. And so it's almost looking as though it's creating a new form of slavery.
Well, there's a wonderful book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, that makes an argument that that one of the ways of understanding the growth in the use of incarceration is by thinking about it as the new Jim Crow, as a new way of controlling young black men. And I think it's a terrific book. And in fact, the only other time in U.S. history when there was a similar growth in the use of incarceration was in the South after the Civil War.
Yes.
About 20 years, there was a growing prison population in the South, and it's primarily the same thing, primarily young black men who produced that growth. You know, and I'm very sympathetic with this caller's point, because part of what the punishment imperative was about was that in every way we tried to become more punitive. So we restricted the job possibilities of people who were released from prison, eliminating Pell Grants for students, people who were incarcerated, eliminating college loans for students who were convicted of drug-related crimes, cutting off whole lines of work for people who had been to prison, telling people who had felony convictions that you're not allowed to vote for president even though you have served your time. In fact, the political consequences of that are pretty significant. If people in Florida who had felony convictions had been able to vote for president, the second George Bush would never have been elected president. In every place in U.S. Social policy where we could get tougher on people who had involvement in the criminal justice system, we did, including supervision of people, as the caller said, supervision of people who had been released from prison. One of the ways that people get pushed back into the system is through revocation of probation or parole, mm-hmm. and revocation rates for probation or parole have increased, partly because we are providing more surveillance, partly because there are more rules that are put on people, and partly because they are being enforced more severely. And and you would think that an institution that had a 60% failure rate, as prison does, would be one that we would stop investing in. But prisons continue to get invested in, even though upwards of two-thirds of the people who left prison went back again, did not succeed in society. We continue to make that investment there, and we continue to make it less likely that the people who went to prison would be able to succeed. So there's I think there is, in fact, you can make a case that in every respect, this policy of punitiveness was a deliberate policy that was related to the idea that if we become more punitive, people will straighten up their lives. And in fact, I think we've learned that is not the pattern that occurs.
And as we take our break now, we want to encourage our listeners to give us a call here and become a member, and you may also get a volume of this very important work, The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. And when we return, we will talk to Professor Clear about some of the proposed solutions he offers.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us, for tuning in, and for bringing us this wonderful program. Yes, dear listener, I'm thanking you for bringing us this program, because it is your support that makes it possible for us to put a microphone in front of folks like Cecil and Celeste, and for them to make that not at all toll-free call to the professor here, who's laying out all this crucial information for us right now. But what is toll-free is the number you call to make your fully tax-deductible donation right now, your investment in community radio, 877-500-5266. My name is Sam, and I'm also reminding you that you can make your investment at KBOO.FM. I'm joined here this morning by Ms. Kristen right now.
That's me.
Yes. And we're also joined through the airwaves and through their support, Live Honeybees of Portland. They say KBOO is the only radical local radio, and I agree. Seven of Portland says KBOO is the only radio station worth listening to. Thank you. Thank you for joining in with the KBOO Foundation and bringing everyone this sort of information, this sort of radio. John of Corvallis particularly enjoys a whole bunch of range of music he hears right here on KBOO, and Democracy Now!, which we heard a little bit ago this very morning. What is it you like about KBOO? Why do you keep tuning in? Why are you going to call 877-500-5266? Make that call right now and tell my friend Joel all about it. Maybe you'll get to speak to David. Who knows? Maybe you'll even get to talk to Sun. I don't know. But you, none of us will know until you call 877-500-5266.
Calling in and offering your financial support is one way to get involved. And as you know, this is a call-in program. Every day we have, every weekday we have some call-in programs, an opportunity for people to voice their concerns and opinions about what's happening in our world. We talked, Frances called in today. She made an excellent point about how, you know, one of our leaders, you know, had definite ties to Measure 11. That was a huge deal, the three-strike rule. Who benefited from that? Our children, our families, our neighbors? No, corporations. So we need to keep it real. Help us keep it real by calling 877-500-5266.
Online at kboo.fm. We're about to go back to this conversation. So why not make that call right now? Get it out of the way. Make sure you don't miss even 1 minute. Cecil?
Thank you so much. And Professor Clear, you not only offer analysis of the prison system, but also offer some possible solutions or a way to go beyond for next steps. So one thing that you mention in your book is something that I think is termed justice reinvestment. Could you explain what that is?
So a lot of money is spent incarcerating people in the United States, and if we reduce the size of the prison population, a great deal of money will be saved from those investments. So the average cost of putting a person in prison is about $50,000 a year. So you can imagine that if you reduce the prison population and take those savings and use that money to invest in those communities that have such large numbers of people cycling through the criminal justice system, you would not only be able to improve the infrastructure of those places, but you would also begin to get at the very social problems and the very economic and other kinds of problems that lead to people getting involved in crime in those communities. For example, you could improve school systems. You could decrease the number of school dropouts. You could decrease the number of children who are hungry. You could improve the number, the quality of parenting of children who are raised there. There's lots of ways that you could use that money to create changes in communities. The justice reinvestment idea is to downsize the prison system, take the money that's saved there and invest it in places that are producing large numbers of people who are cycling through the criminal justice system.
Now, even though those are forms of reinvestment to rebuild the community, separate in a sense from the actual prison population, it really does help, because one of the things it does is create a better net to reduce recidivism. But what would really be helpful, I think, for a lot of our listeners is to talk to some of your strategies to kind of help dismantle the whole prison imperative and the punishment imperative. And you talk about some of the strategies such as repealing mandatory sentences, especially for drugs, and then reducing length of stay in the prison. Now, there are, of course, people who are going to say, well, some folks belong in prison. But in the way you present this, you actually not only address that, but address how the justice reinvestment is a really important part of actually creating a more realistic and relevant penal system.
So, yes. The iron law of prison populations is this. Prison populations are produced by how many people go to prison and how long they stay. It's like hotels. Hotels are filled by people going to them and people staying in them. And since what we've done to produce our prison population is to increase the proportion of people who go to prison and to increase how long they stay there, we have completely within our own control the ability to reduce the size of to eliminate mass incarceration and to reduce the size of the prison population. So just as an example, cutting to the quick, if we went back to the sentencing policies that were in place in 1980, within a few years, we would have the prison population of 1980. The prison population is not being produced by crime rates. It's not being produced by public safety problems. It's being produced by the policies that we use to punish people. There's no better example than drug-related crime. In the early 1970s, it was not uncommon for states to have less than 10% of their prison population be people who were incarcerated for drug-related crime, and less than 15% of the people going into prison for those drug-related crimes. Today, it's not at all. It is generally the case that as many as a third of the people or even 40% of the people are there on a drug-related crime, and more than half of the people going into prison are going into prison on drug-related crime. That's because we've changed sentencing for people who get arrested for drugs. So one of the obvious ways to do this would be to change the laws that we have for punishing people who are convicted of drug-related crime. And I would point out that locking people up for drug crime has almost no impact on public safety, because whenever you lock up a person for being involved in drug distribution networks, you create a job opening for someone else to get involved distributing those drugs, because the demand stays the same. Mm-hmm. So instead of having what you do is you destabilize these neighborhoods even more by creating large numbers of people flowing in and out of prison, and when they go to prison, someone else gets involved in dealing drugs, and when they come back out from prison, you create all the strains that are involved when somebody comes out of prison and wants to get involved in the and there's the drug business going on there, and they want to get back involved in it again. So the three areas that we have most significantly affected drug prison populations are drug laws, mandatory sentencing, where we restrict the use of probation for people convicted of certain kinds of crimes, particularly drug-related crime, and then recidivism sentencing, where we double and triple the length of sentences for people who are convicted of a second felony offense or a third felony offense, that kind of two strikes and three strikes, you're out kinds of policies. So, for example, in 1972, we had 200,000 prisoners in the United States. Today we have almost that many people serving life sentences in the United States. Just we have a permanent prison population that's almost that same size because of the extended use of life sentences.
We can
crimes that we have available for life sentences has skyrocketed. So it's been there's a lot of talk about trying to do prison programs with people, and that we should do them. We should offer programs to people who are incarcerated. There's a lot of talk about reentry, about trying to provide supports to people who are leaving prison and coming back to society, and we should do that as well. But really, the solution to the problem of mass incarceration does not lie in prison programs or reentry programs. It lies in going back to a more sane set of sentencing policies that will produce the prison population that we are willing to tolerate.
Well, we'll have to pause our conversation at this point, and we want to thank you, Professor Clear, for joining us. We want to urge all members to give us a call here so that they may pick up a copy of your book and read in more detail not only your analysis, but also the solution. So thank you very much, Professor Todd Clear, for joining us this morning and offering your book, The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And we look forward to perhaps having another visit. And we want to encourage people who have yet to call in and become a member, do so now. We bring you these programs, we bring you these guests, we bring you these books to help really solidify our place in your information network. Where else can you hear solutions to the punishment imperative? A lot of stations may bring people to talk about sentencing. They may talk about crime. They may either get you all excited about the possibility that we need a new prison or the possibility that crime is on the rise. But very rarely do you hear people who will actually pull the curtain back and look at the policies and the attitudes that will get us either fired up and fearful or fired up and empowered.
So how many people participate and get a copy of this for only $60?
For only $60 by calling 877-500-5266 or by going to www.kboo.fm and at our main page up in the right-hand upper corner is a place to donate now where you can make a pledge. This is an interesting book. As we said, this helps you sharpen your arguments, and with the solutions that are pointed out by authors Clear and Frost, you know how to approach our legislators and what to say and how to frame an argument to get them to listen about coming up with saner sentencing, shorter length of stay, and the kinds of crimes that should be approached that really make a difference to public safety.
And so for $60, you can become knowledgeable about this system and what to do about it. And I think, Sam, it's a lot cheaper than what you paid for your degree.
Very much so. In fact, I have called KBOO more than once my free university of the airwaves, and that works in a couple of different ways. I can I and any member of the community can learn how to make radio. It's that sense, it's a radio university, and it's also a radio-based university in just about any topic, whether it's gardening, whether it's political science, whether it's musicology. I've learned so much about the music that I listen to just from hearing it on KBOO, because the people who put the music on really know it inside and out, up and down, backwards and forwards. That's what you're supporting with your call, 877-500-5266. Political and musical and cultural ambassadors who bring the information to you, delivered right into your ear hole, because your friends and neighbors stepped up, and now it's your turn. 877-500-5266 or on any page on the KBOO.fm website, you can click that little cartoon jar. It will take you through a convenient, safe, and secure, and quite easy process to get your dollars into KBOO to keep KBOO pumping out all that you have come to rely on it for over 47 years.
That's true. And going right along with that idea that we have a university here, our Cecil shared with me today that he was a student of Cornell West at the New York Seminary School University. And that is amazing. I mean, he's here. He's here talking to us. He is a valuable part of our community, and we're putting a microphone in his face and telling and asking him to share his knowledge with us, and he's doing it. And that is gold. That is a amazing contribution.
I'd say it's even
priceless.
Better than gold.
It's priceless.
Yes. What you got there?
I got a new member named Steven from Lake Oswego.
All right, Lake Oswego. So what's that? Washington County is in the house. So how about Clark County? How about Yamhill County? How about Clackamas County? Give us a call right now. 877-500-5266. Why not make your ongoing monthly investment of $5 or more each month for KBOO, for community radio, for your community, and pick up for yourself or for a friend or someone you don't like very much, I don't know, it's up to you, a copy of The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarcerations in America. And no disrespect to Professor Claire and Mr. Frost, but I would quibble with that a little bit and say that mass incarceration hasn't failed. It's succeeded wildly in generating profits at the expense of public safety. You know, when something fails in its stated goals and continues and it's continually supported over and over again, it's time to start looking elsewhere. Like, what are its real goals? It must be succeeding somehow to garner such support, just like KBOO has succeeded for over 46 years since 1968 in bringing you this kind of information. And because it has succeeded, it has continued to have your support, the support of your friends and neighbors. And now it is time to step up one more time. 877 500 5266. Some members of your community that have joined up, that have stepped up to support KBOO in a way that made sense to them, were some restaurants. They make food, so they got involved to feed our volunteers. That's Bar Carlo, open Wednesday to Monday at from 8:30 p.m. to 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. 6433 Southeast Foster. Little River Cafe, open 7 days a week at 7 a.m. 0135 Southwest Montgomery. And Corbett Fish House at 5901 Southwest Corbett Avenue, open Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Saturday, Sunday at noon, using 100% rice bran oil for their fish and chips. And Little River serving breakfast sandwiches and salads and burgers along the Willamette River. And Bar Carlo is serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, happy hour. It's all happening to support KBOO, and now it's time for you to make that call. So do it right now.
Tune in on October 6th at 6 p.m. for an hour-long Prison Pipeline special. Host Amy Johnson will interview Michael H. Fox of the Worldwide Women's Criminal Justice Network about how guilt by association laws and ideas of what makes an unfit mother have put women innocent of committing or planning murder behind bars for crimes committed by men. Michael Fox will shine a spotlight on the cases of Carlin Eckloff, Tammy Traxtel, and Kaisha Johnson, all serving over 25 years in Oregon for crimes they did not commit. This show will air during our membership drive, and it's your chance to support KBOO and Prison Pipeline. Thanks for tuning in on October 6th at 6 p.m.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour, brought to you by the fabulous KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Ivan Hale, and our engineer today is Joe Clement. We are streaming live and around the globe at www.kboo.fm, and we encourage you to get on and tune in at any means necessary to what we have for you today. The Old Mulver.